Hello and welcome to my talk on navigating the ARM Bootstrap Matryoshka. My name is Ahmad Fatoum. I am an embedded software engineer with Pingotronics, a German Linux consulting company where I have been involved in a number of projects around ARM SoCs and had the chance to use and develop parts of bootchains on ARM SoCs. One of these ARM SoCs is the NXP IMX8MM, which is a multi-core ARM Cortex A53. It's the same like on the Raspberry Pi 3, and it also can have has a Cortex M4 as coprocessor. It's one of the first 64-bit ARM SoCs and implements the first specification for them, which is ARM version 8.0a. We are picking one specific SoC for this talk because this early bootstrap stuff is very different from SoC to SoC. The basic flow is the same, but how it's actually implemented differs considerably, so we best stick to one of them. And we stuck here to the IMX8MM because the IMX series has comparatively open documentation and good open source software support due to that. And it's also used in some open source, in some projects that have their focus on open source software use, like the MNT Reform laptop, which uses an 8MQ, and the Purist Limbrim 5, which uses an 8MM, like the one we will talk about here. So how does the boot start on an IMX8MM? It's not much different than on any other SoC at the very first. Normally you have a program that executes another program, and that program is executed by another program, but the first program needs to start from somewhere. And this somewhere is called the reset vector. Vector is an older term for a pointer. So where does this reset vector point at? The implementation, which is NXP in this case, which integrates the ARM SoC, decides on an address. And at that address, there must be some memory chip that you can execute off from. This could be an on-chip SRAM. But the problem with such a RAM is that someone needs to preload it, because when it comes out of reset, it doesn't have actual code in it that you can execute. This works when you don't bootstrap the first CPU. So your primary CPU has started, and then you want to bootstrap your second CPU. So the first CPU could load code for a second CPU to execute into RAM. So that works. But for the first CPU, we need something else. Another way is to have memory mapped flash. So that's flash that looks like memory and can be connected just like memory, or it has a controller that make it appear to the CPU as if it were something that's memory mapped. And you can just read off it and execute off it. The problem with that is that you have an extra flash chip that you need to program. And that extra flash chip that is accessible over that way is usually not the same storage that you use for the rest of the system, because it's usually slower or more expensive. And there is a security hazard as well, because anyone who can get his hands on the hardware could desolder the chip, replace it with his own, and then they own the system basically. So what is now the norm on any modern SoC is a mask boot ROM that you can disable. So you have fused into the chip a ROM, and that ROM starts as soon as you start off your power on reset. This saves effort because you can have software on in your boot ROM that, for example, over USB allows you to program the rest of your system. And it saves cost because you can then boot off a SATA SSD or boot off flash or an MMC SD card and so on. So you don't need more than that one chip that you use for your boot chain and for your actual system. And if you trust the crypto implementation of the vendor of your SoC, you can use it to verify your bootloader and start a trusted boot chain that way. So you can use it as a building block to ensure no one else can flash unsigned software on your system. These are the generic considerations. The boot ROM in the IMX8M behaves like this. So what does it actually do? At the start, it needs to configure the PLLs and the clocks. So you got these two clock inputs, for example, a slow clock at 32 kilohertz or so, and a clock at 20 megahertz. And then you need to get all these different frequencies that you need for the different IP blocks in your system. So you have USB, you have an SD card, you have a peripherals inside that need to be clocked, you have a memory controller, and so on. All these need different clocks with different frequencies. And so you need to configure these PLLs at the start with their frequencies, and then you have a tree of dividers and so on to reach all these frequencies you need. And the boot ROM does that for the hardware that it needs to use. It also needs to do some more initialization for the hardware. For example, you have an array of SRAMs for different things, and you need to configure the latencies, because at start the CPU doesn't know about these different parts that are on the system, on chip. What it also does on CPU level is set up a stack for execution and an initial interrupt vector table. When this basic setup is done, it will need to think about actually bootstrapping the system. This works by taking some configuration from the user and then deciding on where to boot from. During development, this configuration comes from the strapping pins. You see here an example that's a DIP switch on an evaluation kit, and you can encode in these DIP switches, you see that to the upper left, a sequence that tells the SoC's boot ROM to, okay, please start off the download mode for recovery, or start from SD card 1 or from the eMMC in the second slot, and so on. This is very nice for development. If you don't have a DIP switch, you can also do it directly by wiring pull-ups and pull-downs on your board. But for actual use, you will want to persist this configuration, but you can't do that via strapping pins. You can just desolder them, and you can change the code, because that's ROM, that's read-only memory. You have no access to that. But what you can do is that you have these electronically blowable fuses inside of the SoC that you can blow. And when you blow that fuse, for example, that means boot from that mechanism. When you blow that fuse, that means disable recovery boot or enable the watchdog. So now the SoC knows what to look at to boot the system. And well, it has a list of stuff to try, and then it does that in order. And it can be quite extensive, all these different boot medias and mechanisms that a boot ROM can use. Here is my favorite example, which is a Texas Instruments SoC, and I have marked some points: RNDIS, BootP, and TFTP. So how they interact with each other is that basically the SoC sets up a USB gadget. It does via RNDIS Ethernet over USB on top of that. It runs a DHCP client on top of that. It gets an IP address and then uses the UDP-based TFTP protocol to actually fetch something over the network. And all that is really wired hard into the chip, which I find quite impressive for software you can change. And software, like everything else that's complex, has bugs. And boot ROMs are no exception to that. So sometimes workarounds are possible. Here is an example where the boot ROM configures the clock tree in a way that a divider is out of spec, and this leads to an unstable system. Okay, if you come early enough in the bootloader, you can fix that before a problem happens. And if a problem happens, you have your watchdog. But sometimes this is not possible, which is, for example, this vulnerability, which was a buffer overflow during signature checking in older IMX boot ROMs. And the only fix for that is to get new hardware, which is unfortunate. So, back to our new IMX8M. So now it knows where to boot from, for example, of an SD card. And the first thing it looks for is that at a specific offset, it expects a header. For the IMX, this header is called an image vector table. so vector pointer, so it's a series or a table of pointers. One pointer is to device configuration data, more on that on the next slide. One more is for the bootloader binary, which we actually want to load as our next stage. The load address, where should it be copied? And a command sequence file, which includes our signature, which is needed for a trusted boot. And NXP signed HDMI 5 firmware. So one thing is not like the others. Why do you have to worry about HDMI during very, very early boot? And the thing is, you have NXP. NXP has its customers and it wants to give them the ability to certify for streaming, for example, a high definition Netflix video. And how do you do that? By encrypting the content that goes over the HDMI link. But if you just allow anyone to flash software on the HDMI file, they could siphon out the keys. So they say, okay, only our software can be flashed, and that's ensured by the signature, and the boot ROM does the check of the signature, and it turns off the JTAG during the check and turns it off on, so I can't use a hardware debugger to influence it. And well, and that's the reason you need to do that very early on in the boot ROM context, the loading of the firmware. And yeah, you can also set a flag whether your boot image is a plugin. More on that on the slide after that. So, IMX device configuration data. This is an IMX specific feature, which is basically having bytecode that's executed by a virtual machine implemented in the boot ROM. This runs before your actual ARM code runs, and it can do memory accesses. It can write 8 or 16 or 32 bit literals. It can poll until a bitwise end operation is true, and it can set and clear bits via